Chapter 5, The Food Chain. Bassano, Alberta sits just off the Trans-Canada Highway, 87 miles east of Calgary. It's the kind of lightly rolling prairie country that people claim to hate driving through. Yet show them a photograph of a small combine, doggedly wading into vast yellow canola acres, below the wide blue sky with ranks of white cumulus receding to the horizon, and they might just marvel at what a good photographer can make out of nothing. Those who grow up there need no assistance in seeing its beauty. Bassano is the first place my mother remembers. In 1929, when she was 3 years old, the Slorence family relocated to Bassano, where Jock would run a bakery. Joan's earliest memories include her personal picnics. The menu was crackers and water, held in fields of prairie grass with the crickets and meadowlarks and the unbroken horizon. One summer day, while driving east on a journey back to Brandon, I see the Bassano turnoff and decide to take it. It's a chance to replace my vague mental picture with first-hand observations, buttressed by a few digital photos. I pass the gas station and the grain terminal, cross the railroad tracks, drive along residential streets with real trees, quickly reach the little downtown. Unlike many prairie communities, Bassano has more or less held its own. The innovative floating dam opened in 1914 never quite produced the civic boom the town's founding fathers had hoped, but the community maintains a population of roughly 1,400 and shows no sign of withering away like so many other farming centers battling the steady urban migration of the young. The Imperial Hotel still stands on the wide main street. It's been there as long as the town. These days, there's no lobby. The only public entrance is to the saloon. Give or take a few video lottery terminals, the room looks as it must have 100 years ago, and the proof is mounted near the entrance. A 78-pound sturgeon pulled out of the Bow River near the Bassano Dam in the year 1913. My grandfather would have seen that sturgeon, but such barroom wonders would have been off-limits to the children and women folk. A few old men perch in front of the VLTs. An unsmiling 40-ish woman in a sweatshirt and pulled-back hair wipes the bar and nods at the mention of a bakery. "It used to be across the street," she says. She's right, too. Small towns have long memories. In 1997, British scientists took DNA from a 9,000-year-old skeleton found in a cave near Cheddar, England, and traced it to a living relative, a history teacher named Adrian Target, who lived about a half mile from where the bones were found. Bassano was only founded in 1911, but call back in the year 7873 and someone at the barber shop will probably know who caught that sturgeon. There's a Bassano-era photo of our mother and her sister Margaret, probably 6 and 5 years old, dressed in the Highland outfits they wore in local dance competitions. Mum doesn't look happy, but that may simply be because, as the older member of the little troupe, she had to dance the boys' part. Mum didn't talk too much about her home life. She understood our derisive opinions of Grandma and did not like to fuel the fire. But one story is memorable. When Grandma wanted to punish her children, even over minor issues, they would be sent to the cellar steps. The door would close behind them, and they would be left there until they apologized. Young Joan would not apologize. The cellar was pitch black and unheated. "I would sit there forever," Mum told us. Eventually, some face-saving truce would have to be brokered by her father, allowing little Joan to emerge from the dark and go to bed. Like her mother, Joan had will, and even at that early age, it was bent on defiance. The Slorence family dynamic was not a simple one. Each of the three children experienced their youth differently. About younger sister Margaret's life and experiences, I cannot really speculate. I know that her relationship with her mother was difficult, but how it ultimately shaped her life, I do not know. About Stan, I know a little more. Whereas Joan battled her mother and found refuge in her father's affection, her older brother's experience was nearly the reverse. Stan was a born comedian and prankster, who would eventually spend a happy time touring the country in summer stock theatrical productions. Once, when my teenage mother was preparing for one of her first dates, Stan scattered some of her undergarments around the living room, before ushering Joan's suitor into the parlor. "Oh, that Joan," Stan said, picking up a bra. "She just leaves this stuff lying around any old place." Stan was his mother's favorite, surely a mixed blessing even then, but suffered under the weight of his father's expectations of what a man should be. Jock Slorence expected toughness, and his preferred seasoning technique was boxing. Stan endured regular beatings from his father, no less painful for being conducted under the Marquess of Queensberry rules. Years later, Stan would get a tearful apology from his father. "That was the way we thought things were supposed to be done," Jock told his son. The Bassano Bakery did well for a while. Even the Depression did not seem, at first, a fatal blow. Jock Slorence still managed to open up a new bake shop and confectionery on Main Street in July 1932. But in this part of the world, the worst blows of the Depression were yet to come. The initial crash and subsequent economic slump were trouble. Still ahead were biblical plagues of drought, dust storms, hail, and grasshoppers that would spell death for many little towns in southern Alberta. God, it seemed, had lost a bundle on the market and was throwing a tantrum. Fire is another popular scourge, one the Almighty often outsources to human agents. Bassano seems to have burned down a piece at a time several times over. Meeting halls, hardware stores, vacant shops, the Hunter Hotel, all lighting up in their turn. It had to be discouraging to any spirit of progress. "Gem Theater makes improvements," reads an August 1928 Bassano Mail headline. "New piano and up-to-date motion picture machine install." It is reported that the proprietor hopes soon to be able to show movies continuously without stopping the show to change reels. All for naught. In 1930, the Gem would burn to the ground. For the next few years, the only big popcorn events in Bassano would be fires. They were still a regular source of diversion, though. Reading the archives of the Bassano Mail is like reading about the Great Chicago Fire in installments. Here's one from May 9th, 1935. Fire destroys inside of local bake shop. Early morning blaze destroys oven and walls of building. Prompt action of fire brigade subdues fire in hour. Early the previous Sunday, the Mail reported, one Jas Snape of nearby Countess was motoring down deserted Main Street and saw the blaze. He awakened the proprietor, who according to the Mail was named John Slornass, and raised the alarm. 500 feet of hose was laid. The gentle breeze blowing at the time did not spread the fire. The origin of the configuration, the reporter perhaps meant conflagration, had not yet been determined. The oven was rendered unfit for further use, 3 of the 4 walls and ceiling ruined, 700 pounds of flour ruined. The condition of the molder and mixer still unclear. No other casualties. There was no insurance. Losing the bakery would be a setback for Bassano as well as the family. For a little town in the 30s, a local bakery was a precious convenience. So other Bassano merchants offered Jock and Annie Slorence no-interest loans to help them rebuild. They did. But troubles were mounting now. With the Depression deepening, Jock Slorence was supplying bread to grocery stores that could no longer pay their bills. The bakery delivered the bread anyway. One day, Jock reluctantly confronted a grocer whose check had bounced. The merchant was sympathetic. In fact, he was outraged at the behavior of those high-handed bankers. "You mean they didn't cash it?" he fumed. Picking up the telephone, he called the bank. Jock listened as he tore into the manager for the mix-up. "Okay," the grocer told Jock after ringing off. "I straightened it out. Go on back to the bank, and they'll take care of it." Jock took the check back to the bank, whereupon he discovered that the merchant's creditors included the phone company. The telephone at the grocery store had not been working for several days. Eventually, the Slorence family business fell apart. The bakery was turned over to the government for unpaid taxes. Facing destitution was trouble enough, but the failure must have been particularly hard on a couple whose relationship functioned best as a business partnership. Annie was tough, frugal, and financially shrewd, She had kept the books while Jock handled the baking. It's unlikely they had a lot of romance to fall back on. Now came one of those rare episodes that we kids would hear about firsthand from Mum. She would have been about 11 or 12 years old at the time. Her dad, professionally frustrated and personally miserable, decided to leave his wife. Jock Slorence packed his bag, went out the door, and down the steps. And then, years before Wayne Newton would turn the same scenario into a maudlin pop song, my mother ran after him and grabbed onto his leg. "Don't leave me," she pleaded. He turned around. That story is one of the most heartbreaking I know. But then, I knew my grandmother. Finally, Jock found a business partner, a Rosetown, Saskatchewan cafe owner with a vacant building suitable for a new bakery. Rosetown would soon become a symbol of better times in the agricultural business, a service center for some of the most successful farms in the province. Jock Slorence managed to secure a large supply of baker's malt, allowing him to crank out a steady supply of sweet baked goods much in demand. With the three kids working shifts after school, the bakery business boomed. The financial problems, at least, were over. Margaret and Stan worked back in the bakery. Joan worked up front in the retail operation selling bread. "She was very good with customers," Margaret says. "Mother used to say to me, 'Why can't you be more like Joan?'" A long time later, Joan told me Mother used to ask her, "Why can't you be more like Margaret?" Good retail skills aside, there was another reason Joan worked up front. They thought she was too frail to work in the bakery. To some extent, the difficulties of my mother's youth must be inferred. She didn't go on about it. We knew what her mother was like. We heard the occasional story of conflict. We knew that being caught up in her parents' corrosive relationship would have been disastrous for a child. But the main reason we know my mother had a difficult childhood is that it almost killed her. For years, she had been chronically unable to keep food down. At age 13, Joan weighed less than 60 pounds. Her teeth were being eaten away by stomach acid. She was starving to death. The family doctor declared that without prompt action, she would likely be dead within 2 months. Annie Slorence was a tough and difficult woman. But her essential nature is a matter of debate. In his book, The Hero with a Thousand Faces, Joseph Campbell describes the archetypal tyrant he calls Holdfast. Holdfast lays waste to whatever domain he commands. This may be no more than his household, his own tortured psyche, or the lives that he blights with the touch of his friendship and assistance, Campbell writes. But, Campbell points out, often it is the hero who becomes the tyrant. The same qualities that allow for effective action are later employed to maintain power and control. What transforms hero into tyrant is the inability to recognize that the situation has changed and that new skills are now needed. When her family was in crisis back in Hoyk, Grandma was heroic. But fierce will and dogged persistence aren't always enough. You can't tackle parenthood like a lion takes down a zebra. Although I disliked Grandma intensely, I never really thought she had sufficient self-awareness to understand her effect on those around her. Her youngest daughter disagrees. "She knew what she was doing," Margaret told me, "but it didn't matter. She didn't care." I'm not sure. Grandma seemed to me no more malicious than that hungry lion. Mum told us the story of coming home after the doctor's dire warning and being taken up to her room. Her mother slipped in to keep watch. "She thought I was asleep. She started crying. It was the only time in my life I ever really heard her cry," my mother said. Seriously ill? Saskatchewan, circa 1939, would not be the statistician's recommended locale. Yet two factors now worked in Joan's favor. With the family finances on the upswing, there was money. And being the daughter of former amateur golf champ Annie Barron, finally moved into the advantage column. A crisis required action, and action she understood. Just point her at a zebra and she was fine. Mother and daughter were soon on a train bound for Minnesota and the Mayo Clinic. The diagnosis was achalasia, essentially a failure of the esophagus. Her stomach, doctors discovered, had shrunk to the size of a walnut. Mayo Clinic physicians offered two possible explanations for Joan's case. One was prolonged emotional stress. The other was swallowing lye soap. Shortly thereafter, and for the rest of her life, Annie Slorence would tell the story of how her impish teenage daughter had swallowed lye soap. I'm sure she was already convinced of its truth the first time she told it. Joan underwent immediate force feeding. "They would feed me every hour," she recalled, "to stretch my stomach. One bite of potato and I would feel full. Then I would have to eat again." Did young Joan really get achalasia as the result of stress? More than 7 decades after that speculative diagnosis, there's no real way of knowing. Even now, the reasons for achalasia are not well understood. But achalasia is not anorexia. The results may look similar. But an achalasia sufferer starves for reasons that are strictly mechanical. The consumption apparatus won't function. Yet when I think of my mother's teenage medical crisis, I'm reminded of other teens who slowly dwindle away. It has been said of anorexia nervosa patients that they seek control, and calorie intake is the simplest way to exert total control over one's body. I don't believe my mother's achalasia represented a subconscious attempt to exert control over her circumstances. That would be a facile diagnosis made long after the fact. But the parallels, at least, are worth noting. My mother was a woman who very much wanted control over her own life. She and her own mother were engaged in a battle of strong wills. Somehow, for young Joan, the result was near starvation. Joan's physical problem may not have been what we now call an eating disorder. But looking at a mother-daughter struggle like theirs brings to mind a phrase that seems suspiciously appropriate: eat or be eaten. A network of personal relationships can sometimes resemble a food chain. Not all of us are the dominant predators of our own lives. A child subject to a cruel or domineering parent, or an employee toiling for an unforgiving boss, is forced into a kind of subjugation. She lives the nervous, wary life of a zebra or antelope. All the while, her greatest dream is freedom. Not necessarily as a hunter, but perhaps as something like the noble elephant, independent and unafraid. Even as she struggled to regain control over her own rebellious body, my mother was surely aiming for more. At 13 years of age, she was already looking ahead to the day of escape, freedom, and control. Her goal was not dominance, only autonomy. Joan Slorence struggled and suffered through her youth because she was not cut out for subservience. She needed to be her own master. She needed to escape the tyranny of the food chain. Meanwhile, her medical problem and its treatment had several consequences. She got false teeth while still in her teens. She developed a lifelong loathing of feeling full, later to be cursed with a husband who is constantly pestering her to eat from his overstuffed plate. And her swallowing problems never disappeared. In the middle of many family meals, she would quietly excuse herself and disappear down the hall to the bathroom to remove a lump of food that had simply stopped in her throat like a lost tourist. Worst of all was when it happened, as it did with reliable frequency, during a restaurant meal or a social outing. For a woman who hated to bring attention to herself, it was a regular trial. But she rebounded. Slowly, the pounds came back. By high school graduation, photographs show an admittedly slight but beautiful young woman. My grandmother was no cartoon villain. The Minnesota mission showed her talent for decisive action, but was by no means the only notation on the good side of her celestial ledger. Back in Bassano, in that pre-social safety net era, the family had taken in a destitute and abandoned child named Ada. And for all her shortcomings as an emotional provider, Annie was at the very least looking after the practical interests of her children in an admirably progressive fashion. For years, she had reliably taken her children's bakery wages and socked them away in an education fund. There probably weren't too many students from Rosetown, Saskatchewan, destined for Eastern universities. All three of the Slorens children would go. In 1944, 18-year-old Joan Slorens, a slender redhead with suspiciously good teeth, arrived at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario. She enrolled in English literature and moved into Ban Rye Hall. She joined the Queen's Highland Dancers, a troupe that performed at the football games. Shy, she nonetheless began making friends. One night, an outgoing pal named Pat initiated a hairstyle makeover, framing Joan's high forehead with fashionable bangs. In a portrait taken shortly afterward, Joan looks back over her shoulder and smiles. Pat must have smiled too. The bangs worked for Joan. With her mother miles away in Rosetown, she probably put on a few useful pounds as well. I don't imagine Joan ever saw the 1936 musical Follow the Fleet with Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers. A sensible person might be afraid to go to the movies in Bassano, at least not before locating the fire exits. Still, they built the Orpheum a few years after the gym burned down, so she could have taken it in. If so, she'd have done well to take a few notes. There's a subplot involving Harriet Hilliard, later to become a household name as Harriet Nelson, co-star of The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet. Shy, retiring Harriet is a bit of a wallflower. Then she gets a makeover and attracts the attentions of Randolph Scott, a handsome Navy man. On a campus far from Hollywood, Joan Slorens's sweet-smiling, bangs-bedecked portrait would soon take up residence in the dorm of a besotted young naval officer. Rogers and Astaire they weren't, but they would certainly dance. And, as in any good romance, the plot would take a few hard twists. Chapter 6. Made on a Friday. I'm pretty sure I was made on a Friday. I don't mean that one day in November 1957 my parents kicked off the weekend by stuffing the existing kids with meatloaf until they were comatose, and then pushing the dresser in front of the bedroom door. The scenario behind my conception never was explained to me, thank goodness. Considering the situation, Mom raising four kids with Dad's contribution consisting almost entirely of his meager United Church minister's salary, one plausible explanation would be liquor. But Mom wasn't a drinker, so the whole project is just hard to fathom. A fifth dependent in a household whose income wasn't even high enough for the family to enjoy the potential tax benefit? Not a good idea. If the yardstick is ordinary common sense, my existence is hard to justify. This implausibility extends to the eventual product. Based on the blueprints, I don't look like a viable concept. In whatever fabrication plant our souls and characters are assembled and bolted, I must have represented a serious logistical problem. Parts taken from Dad, garrulous extroversion, an element of showmanship, emotionality, and a certain naive optimism sometimes shading into outright cluelessness. Mum's contributions. Pronounced introversion, shyness, an intensely private nature combined with an inclination toward the analytical and observational. Down on the shop floor, it must have been like welding a Hummer to a Prius. Some vehicles are described as Friday cars. When an expensive new ride begins to limp along like a three-legged mule, while the electrical system springs more surprises than a Japanese game show, it is sometimes said that the car must have been built on a Friday by a workforce already mentally starting their weekends. So it must have been with me. I can only assume that at the crucial moment of my manufacture, the 5 o'clock whistle blew. Saddled with two sets of parts that really should not exist in the same package, the crew slammed me together with some quick soldering and a few hammer blows and headed for the exits. The results didn't seem promising initially. Scrawny, slightly bluish, sporting a long, ugly red scratch I apparently had given myself in utero, my appearance actually inspired a nurse to say, "Only a mother could love this one." Happily, those mismatched parts turned out to be pretty solid stuff. They put a lot of steel in the fenders back in the day. I've held up pretty well. But it raises the question, how did those parts join up in the first place? What brought Bill Burgess and Joan Florence together? The idea that opposites attract is compelling. It fits with the romantic notion of two halves coming together. Most of the anecdotal examples I've encountered suggest that such impulses are best ignored. Whatever urges toward personal completion drive such pairings, they're usually swamped by a flood of annoyance, and relatively quickly. Sexual chemistry hides the issues for a while, and then it's a mixed bobsled run down a fast winding track. Most of the time, it just doesn't work. There are different kinds of opposites. Some couples differ in temperament, while others are opposed in values and worldview. My friend Ron's parents were an example of the latter. Ron's dad was a professional hockey player, a locker room roustabout Ron used to call cowboy. Ron's mom was an early feminist, a misplaced hippie in a Manitoba farming town. By the time I met Ron in elementary school, they were already arguing about child support. My parents were the first type. They tended to share political opinions and saw eye to eye on issues of morality and social justice. But temperamentally, they might as well have been Yogi Bear and Ranger Smith. There's almost something perverse about it. Joan Florence was a young woman whose hatred of being the center of attention was deep and profound. Bill Burgess was sunny, sweet, gregarious, and on regular occasions, a human embarrassment generator. Being a human embarrassment generator, or HEG, does not necessarily involve clumsiness or boorish behavior. What's really required is a complete lack of malice or suspicion. Thinks the HEG, people waiting in grocery store lineups will appreciate the chance to chat with a stranger. Or, if I drink from my soup bowl, people will understand. How can you get to the tasty dregs with only a spoon? Surely people wouldn't judge my character based on large rainbow-hued food stains on my shirt. That would be crazy. The HEG predicts the reactions of others by the standards of his own benevolent worldview. The Burgess-Florence pairing shouldn't have worked. Yet contrasting styles and temperaments can also complement. Show business is practically founded on the concept. Nobody ever paid to see a comedy about two roommates who both love a tidy bathroom. Bill and Joan offered each other crucial qualities, a lightning influence and a splash of joie de vivre on one side, a steady hand and some needed guidance and sophistication on the other. Held in common was a natural sincerity. Neither possessed the skill or inclination to deceive. Over the years, there would be some necessary adjustments. There would be serious rough patches. But mutual respect and the will to communicate were always there. As a result, these two people, as different in personal style as a parrot and an owl, would be separated only by death. They met at Queens. Joan had already been in Kingston a year when 20-year-old Bill Burgess showed up. Bill was an Ottawa boy, the son of Joe Burgess, a senior civil servant in charge of the dairy industry. The youngest of eight children, Bill was raised mostly by his older sisters. Bill's mother, Lena, had died when he was only 7. He came home one day to see her being loaded into an ambulance. He never saw her again, alive or dead. Little Billy was considered too young to attend the funeral. Bill had first attended Queens in 1943. In 1945, he returned as a young officer fresh from the Royal Canadian Navy. Bill had not seen action. This may be considered his contribution to Allied victory. By his own admission, Bill was the kind of wet-behind-the-ears young officer regular sailors privately mocked. It was a bit of luck that saw him get his commission at all. In the fall of 1944, as he was on his way into the final oral examination before a panel of admirals and captains, the departing officer candidate muttered, "Carthaginian peace." Thus tipped to the coming question, Bill was able to wax on at length about the famous Roman strategy of guaranteeing peace by utterly decimating the homes and fields of their defeated opponent. "The time ran out," Dad says, "before they found out how little I knew about guns and munitions and actually running a ship." He was now a proud probationary sub-lieutenant. A highlight of his brief military career came when he marched a company of trainees straight into a wall. I called out wheel left instead of wheel right. Half of them did it and half didn't. I had to chew the smart ones out for ignoring the order. History's great events splinter into millions of personal stories. For Bill Burgess and countless other Allied soldiers and sailors, the 1945 debut of nuclear weaponry in Hiroshima and Nagasaki did not represent the fearful dawn of a terrible era. It represented deliverance. I should have been appalled, but at the time I just thought, great, it's going to be over. In the great tradition of Navy life, Bill was walking the deck with a broken heart. He'd been writing impassioned letters to a girl back home. Her name was Mary Lou, the daughter of a well-off businessman. Bill already had some reservations about his lady love. Then the dagger to the heart. Friends informed poor, trusting Bill that Mary Lou was really doing her bit for the war effort. They said she was chasing after everything in a uniform, Dad said. One day, Bill was the lone duty officer on board HMCS Lanark in Liverpool, Nova Scotia, when a message arrived. A quick discharge was available to the first officer who could provide evidence of acceptance at a college. Briefly abandoning his post, Bill ran to the telegraph office and sent a telegram to Queens, where he had spent a term 2 years earlier. His acceptance arrived the next day. Dad and the Navy were quits. The old song instructs, one must be a football hero to make it with the beautiful girls. The assumption is that one ought to be a star. Bill Burgess was a decent lineman on a mediocre Queens Golden Gales team. We got beat about 65-10 once, Bill says. Guys were a little pissed off about them running up the score. A college football team is a traveling road show. The Queens team was accompanied by cheerleaders, a pipe band, and Highland dancers. Like the players, the performers needed to run through their paces. So at practice time, the team, band, and dancers would all be at the field together. It was at one of those practices that lineman Bill chased a stray ball that had rolled close to where the pipe band and Highland dancers were standing. Among the dancers, in their comely kilts, one in particular stood out. Later, Bill quizzed friends. Does anybody know that red-headed Highland dancer? I know her, said his friend Marvin. In fact, I've got a date with her the weekend we go to McGill. That weekend attack on Montreal would be a success on many levels. It began with a truly impressive bit of psychological warfare waged by the Kingston visitors. The night before the game, three squadrons of cars were mobilized. Each squad carried a different color of paint. Red cars, gold cars, and blue cars left for the McGill campus in staggered shifts. A lot of the guys in the student body that year were fresh out of the military, Dad says. They were used to running precision operations. By the time fans began arriving for the Saturday contest, the football stadium had been repainted in the official colors of Queens, right down to the fire hydrants. The Golden Gales went on to win the game. That night, a smaller operation prepared to deploy. Marvin, a true wingman, was perfectly happy to set it up. First, he called an old girlfriend to play the role of Bill's companion on a double date. Early in the evening, the switchover was effected. Marvin and his old flame paired up, leaving Bill and Joan together at a hot Montreal jazz club. I guess it wasn't Oscar Peterson, Bill says, but it was somebody good. On Sunday, Joan was coaxed by her best friend Marie to visit a Montreal printing shop. At some point during the big date, Bill had made a chance remark about how football linemen never get the headlines. Thus, when the Queen's contingent boarded the train for the ride home, a special edition was circulating complete with banner headline, Queen's Victorious, Burgess Stars. One day soon afterward, Joan and Marie rode their bicycles down Bill's street and were invited up for coffee. The train of romance was tooting its happy horn. Right away, we found out we could really dance, Dad says. There are black and white photos from that year. Seen from the far side of over half a century's worth of domestic struggle, the pictures are startling. There are a number of shots with Bill in his navy greatcoat and Joan in a fur coat. One shows a laughing Bill holding Joan aloft. They are a traffic-stopping pair. Dad with his wavy black hair, clean jawline and happy grin. Mum with her long red hair, shy smile, and sylph-like frame. It could have been a shot of Ronald Reagan and Jane Wyman horsing around after a long day on the set. Did they see themselves that way? Doubtful. When Dad looks at Queen's pictures, he often cringes at the clothes he was wearing. Despite being the city boy of the pair, he felt himself unsophisticated. How unsophisticated? Once during a road trip with some football buddies, he innocently asked, "What's that white line on the road for?" They couldn't believe it, he recalls with a wince. This spectacular ignorance of motoring knowledge was traceable to his father. A 19th century man, Joe Burgess was already in his 30s when automobiles began frightening the horses. He never owned a car, Dad says. Couldn't see the point of wasting a couple of $1,000 when you could just as easily take the streetcar. Ahead of his time, really. Bill Burgess must have cut quite a figure in 1945. A tall Navy veteran in full sub-lieutenant's regalia. But for proud young sons, ego adjustments are always close at hand. After I got my officer's commission, I went to some reception with my dad. I was wearing my naval uniform, proud as a peacock. And then Dad introduced me to some people. "Have you met my son, Billy?" I was mortified. Nor was he well suited to the role of smooth young swain dressed in navy whites. "I used to go on and on to Joan about history," he says. "I'd talk about the 10 reasons for Confederation and stuff like that." As I say, he really was good-looking. Or perhaps Joan was simply drawn to a man so unself-conscious that he would sweet-talk his lady love with detailed accounts of 19th-century politics. She remained painfully shy. Joan always envied the gregarious nature and social ease displayed by Margaret, who was both more social and more voluptuous. Margaret was always very outgoing and popular. She just seemed to fit in easily. Mum did have other suitors, though. There was one named Roy and another named Walter. We knew of the latter because Mum later reminisced about how she and her roommate Marie would serenade each other in trilling falsetto. "Walter, Walter, lead me to the altar." Walter would find himself left at the curb. Bill and Joan's first kiss was accomplished while she sat perched on the bar of his bicycle. I managed to sort of nuzzle her neck as I pedaled along, and we kissed. Things were pedaling along quickly. At Christmas 1945, Joan came out to Ottawa and met Bill's father. Joe Burgess was impressed. Unlike others in the house, Joan would get up early enough to help him make breakfast. Bill took Joan out skiing to Ottawa's Dome Hill, filled with romantic dreams. "I had visions of us skiing off into the future together." Joan would never put on skis again. As for their glorious future, there was a major faceplant coming just over the next hill. One afternoon in Kingston, Bill had a date with Joan's sister. It was okay, though. Margaret was helping him pick out a ring. "I thought they were a wonderful couple," Margaret says. "They were very good together." The blissful Queen's term came to its April conclusion. Joan Florence returned to Rosetown, engagement ring on her finger. Her mother was waiting. What Annie Florence expected from her daughter's university experiences can only be guessed, but it's unlikely she envisioned them with fulfilling professional lives. Rosie the Riveter had had her moment, but the war was over, and now the world was scheduled to resume its normal course. Men would pursue careers, as doctors or lawyers if they hoped to impress Annie Florence, whereas women would revert to the usual supporting roles. Bill Burgess had plans to be a teacher. His family had urged him to take up medicine, but a young history buff with a squeamish streak is no budding Dr. Kildare. Strike one. A summer visit to Rosetown didn't help. It was Grandma's first look at him. "I'd been working on a road crew earlier that summer, and my clothes, you know, I didn't have anybody giving me advice about that." Strike two. Grandma likely threw in the third strike free. Grandma was too clever to throw a fit. Instead, she sought to offer her impulsive middle child some constructive advice.
Hey, if Bill is planning to stay in school, he'll need your help, Grandma reasoned. While he studies and gets established, he might need you to do secretarial work. Why not stay here and take stenography classes? It will be more practical than going back to Kingston.
Taking her mother's advice, Joan would not return to Queens in the fall of 1946. She and Bill would be separated by a couple of thousand miles, more than enough room for Grandma to bring her game. As the summer of 1946 came to an end, things still seemed to be going well. After visiting Joan, Bill was preparing to leave Rosetown for the next term at Queens, and a September 2nd outing generated a photo record. There are numerous sultry snapshots of 20-year-old Joan. Tellingly, each carries a self-deprecating remark on the back. "Where did I get that stupid grin?" she writes on one perfectly lovely shot. Another is captioned, "The mouth reminds me of Martha Ray," the popular singer and actress whose nickname was Big Mouth. A third is more teasing. "Windblown, I guess that's okay by you." There's a photo of a reed-slim Bill swinging a golf club. "What style," Joan writes. "What a man!" What happened next can be assumed, if not precisely known. A young couple, now thousands of miles apart, one immersed in school, the other isolated in rural Saskatchewan. And Annie Slorence, that assiduous planter, cultivating her garden of weeds. For a while, things seemed okay. Joan kept a scrapbook of campus newspaper clippings, faithfully mailed by Bill. Postcards depicting Queens were carefully pasted in. At the very least, she was missing the idyllic campus life. By the end of 1946, the scrapbook peters out. One day, when Kingston was in the grip of winter, Bill received a package. Inside was Joan's engagement ring. He promptly lost it. "I put it in a drawer at my father's house. I think one of my nieces must have pulled it out. It just disappeared." Bill's career path now changed abruptly. "I was completely in the depths at that point," he says. "I turned to Psalm 23, 'The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want.' It was the only part of the Bible I really knew, and it offered some support. It was the first time the Bible had become personal to me. God became real. I realized later that it also connected me to my father. When I was a very young boy, we would go to church together. I was the youngest, and I was the only one who went with him. Dad would travel for months at a time. Those Sundays were about the only time I had him to myself. I would sit beside him and look around the church and daydream. It was the closest to him I could be." So, in the fall of 1946, Bill Burgess was no longer engaged and no longer bound for a classroom career. He was now a heartsick young lover and a candidate for the ministry. Not that he had given up on romance. "I kept writing to Joan. I was careful about how I signed them. I wrote, 'Yours sincerely,' on the bottom of one, or 'Affectionately yours.' I think I was probably trying to be sarcastic." The letters would continue for more than 2 years. There was one awkward Edmonton visit, but their status remained quo. There were other women. While serving as a student minister on Little St. Joseph Island on Lake Huron, Bill fell into a relationship with a woman named Madge. By that time, he was no longer regaling sweethearts with tales of Canadian political history. He talked about his old girlfriend instead. "I was always talking about Joan," he says, maybe as a bit of an excuse. Poor Madge heard so much about the mysterious, perfect, saintly Joan that she decided to investigate. On a summer trip to Alberta, Madge called her up for a lunch date. Back on St. Joe's Island come fall, Madge was sullen. "You know," she told Bill, "she's just a woman, just an ordinary woman." Bill thought otherwise, but for once, he kept his mouth shut. He kept writing to Joan, awaiting developments. It was a tricky situation. You can't wish unhappiness on a woman you still care about, but neither do you want her to prosper without you. Bill could not know it from her polite letters, but in fact, his former fiancée was not doing well at all. By 1947, the Rosetown Bakery had been sold to a former employee. Jock Lawrence had experienced a remarkable turnaround, from relinquishing a failed business to comfortable retirement in about 8 years. After the sale, the Rosetown Bakery would burn to the ground, reportedly struck by lightning. Grandpa always suspected that if lightning actually was involved, it probably ignited a healthy sprinkling of kerosene. The Lawrence family moved to Edmonton, the relatively bustling Alberta capital, and bought the house at 12008 96th Street. Their new family doctor was quick to get to know them. His response when Joan came for an appointment early in 49 suggests that he had come to understand the family dynamic rather well. "You need to get away from your mother," he told Joan. "If you want to go back to school, I think it would be a good idea, but whatever the reason, you need to get out." Joan conveyed to her parents an edited version of the doctor's advice. Grandma respected doctors. "Going back to Queens is a good idea," she said. "We'll come with you." Grandma promptly arranged the rental of a spacious Kingston apartment. With the other two Lawrence kids already gone from Queens, it would be just the three of them. Joan's new college roommates would be her mother and father. But at least she was coming back. By that time, Bill had left poor Madge and St. Joe's Island behind, moving on to his latest pastoral assignment. He received Joan's news while in the southeast Saskatchewan village of Handsworth. Want further information about Handsworth? Google it. If nothing else, you'll discover an object lesson in web marketing software. Matchmaker.com offers this automated response. Handsworth dating for the Handsworth single. Meet thousands of Handsworth singles through one of the best Handsworth online dating sites. This is both socially and mathematically impossible. Handsworth is now officially classified in Saskatchewan census records as a ghost town. There were still a few Handsworthians above ground in 1948 when Bill arrived. 38, to be precise. I was number 39. "I see you voted for Tommy Douglas in the provincial election," one local told Bill. Since everyone knew exactly how everyone else in town voted, it wasn't hard to spot the new ballot. Handsworth was the kind of town where a person could scan the shelves at the grocery store and figure out what the new student minister had bought for lunch. One day, he drove the church's old Model A Ford to the village post office. A letter from Joan was waiting. I couldn't wait to read it, so I opened it as I was driving home. When I read that she was coming back to Queens, I drove straight into the ditch. None of the 38 potential victims was struck. Nonetheless, the population of Handsworth soon declined by one, a trend that would prove ominous. That fall, Joan and her parents drove across the country to Kingston. If she had looked bad before, that family trek was no help. For years, Bill had been mooning over his framed portrait of Joan, smiling back over her shoulder, her lovely, gentle face framed by her new bangs. When he next caught sight of her, Joan was standing in line to register for the Queen's fall semester. She was emaciated and pale, he says. She really looked awful. Nonetheless, she was soon back into the campus fling. Joan rejoined the pipe band as a Highland dancer. Bill was still a Golden Gales lineman. That year, the big fall game was in Toronto. Bill made sure that he had a seat on the train that would carry the pipers and dancers on the 3-hour journey back to Kingston. That train trip did it, Bill says. When we got home, we took a long walk in McDonald Park. I walked her home, and for the first time in a very long time, I kissed her. Bill Burgess and Joan Lawrence were back together. Then Bill immediately tried to screw it up. His sincere good intentions, obvious by now, were not exactly wedded to a keen sensitivity. I didn't phone her for a whole week after that. There was football practice and a lot of coursework, and by the time I called, she was so mad she didn't want to speak to me. This crisis would be thankfully brief. Surely Joan couldn't stay mad at Bill. Anybody who wasn't her mother could see his essential character. He was as good-natured as a cartoon rabbit. They would be married in Edmonton on December 28th, 1950, during Christmas break. Photos taken at the reception suggest it was a good time. That's nice. It wouldn't last.